Welcome to the Editor's Show of Entrepreneurship and Original Development Podcast. Understanding a journal's aims and scope is a first milestone on the road to publication. Let's discover the views of our associate editor, Mark Friel, from Telfair School Management in the University of Ottawa, Canada. Mark, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much, Vincent. I'm excited to be here.
As a starter, can you briefly introduce yourself and your main research topics?
I work in Canada now, but I moved here in 2006 from the University of Edinburgh. And so my accent's probably a bit of a giveaway. I'm Scottish and it hasn't been polished by 18 years in Canada. I am an economist originally by training. My research is mostly being around innovation and the financing of smaller firms. So the financing of entrepreneurship and innovation is probably the two themes that have dominated most of my work for the last 20 years. More recently, I'm interested in entrepreneurship as an episodic phenomenon. So like many people become entrepreneurs, but for most people that's seen in the rearview mirror rather than as a perspective. And much of our research has been becoming entrepreneurs or being entrepreneurs. And not a lot of it is about having been entrepreneurs. And so I'm kind of interested in that aspect of it. More recently with colleagues here in Ottawa and elsewhere.
The journal updated its aims and scope. What, in your view, makes a paper interesting and courageous, as emphasized by ERD?
Yeah, I don't know. I did think long and hard about this particular question, because we have a tendency to. So I'm an empirical researcher. I'm a quantitative researcher, and I was thinking about this as I was walking back from coffee this morning, and. In the early part of my career, there was certainly a formula to doing that kind of work. And I think a lot of research in the early part of my career, and perhaps a little bit before, was actually fairly formulaic in entrepreneurship. You know, you had a reasonably interesting question, you had a particularly interesting data set, and you ran as a quantitative researcher, you ran a regression analysis, and you presented it this particular way. And I always, as a European, and I think probably unfairly, used to think that Americans were taught to do it like that. That they, you know, they all did resource-based theory of the firm as part of their PhD program, and they all did a particular kind of quantitative methods based on regressions, and so that everything looked kind of like that. And I think a lot of my work in the early days was kind of like that too. And I always felt that Europeans were just a little bit more creative and a little bit more adventurous. And maybe that's just a bias. I think it probably is just a bias. It meant that we had a much greater variety of quality, probably a lower average, but a higher bar, a higher high end. So the variability and the quality of research. And so I was thinking, so what makes courageous research? I think it's a willingness to shake that formula, because I think that formula still exists for quantitative research. I think it still exists for qualitative research as well, that we're quite formulated. We like tried and tested, because tried and tested reviewers understand and editors understand, and we don't then have to constantly defend our research choices, and research is always about choices, and some of them are contentious in the sense that other individuals might have made different choices. So I think it's about, you know, are you prepared to do something differently and take a risk with that? And I think as a journal, our job is to be much more accommodating of those kinds of things. So I had a paper recently where I thought I was trying to do something a little bit different. I probably wasn't. And the editor who was dealing it was very uncomfortable with it and tried to force us back into the formula. I won't say which journal or which paper, but tried to force us back into the formula because they felt that what we were doing wasn't normal, and actually that was a word that was used in the correspondence, wasn't normal. And I think that sense that there is a normal that we must, you know, adhere to is a little bit problematic. Now, that doesn't mean that you can do everything and it doesn't need defense. It has to be defensible, and you have to have good reasons for doing it, but you ought to be brave enough to break from the mold. And I think as a journal we ought to be enthusiastic about accepting those kind of things. I mean, I don't know what our rejection rate is. It's probably pretty high, like most journals. And I know our desk rejection rate is probably reasonably high too. My own desk rejection rate as an associate editor probably somewhere between 30 and 40%. But I am conscious of, if I see something which is unusual, to take my time and read it a second time and think long and hard about whether that's my biases or prejudices that are coming to bear. And I'm sure I don't always get it right, but I do think that, you know, we have a I was going to say lazy. I don't think it is lazy. We have a habit of of falling back on tried and tested. And I think if we're going to do courageous and interesting research, then that's something that we have to be willing to be uncomfortable about. I don't know if that answers the question, but that's kind of, I was thinking about it this morning when I was walking back and about how I'm not very good at it myself. And so I need to be pushed to be made uncomfortable by others. And I think as a journal editor, that's a real opportunity for us to see different things that excite us and make us uncomfortable in the way they're done and what they say, and not to see that automatically as something that we're pushing aside.
How does this relate to make contributions to CRE?
So again, I'll tell an anecdote that's rather self-indulgent, but I tell my graduate students that I was very fortunate in the early part of my career to be part of a network of industrial economists in the UK, and I saw the late great Anglo-American economist Paul Jaworski give a presentation at Cambridge, and in the presentation he said, as social scientists, our jobs are to spot patterns in data. We then have explanations for those patterns, and explanations are our theories. And so I've always thought theories are about explaining data, or explaining patterns in data, and so that their utility rests on how good they are for providing explanations for things. As a quantitative researcher who is, I think, probably weak on theory, and anybody who's read my work would probably agree with me that I'm not strong on theory, I've always seen theory as something to help me explain patterns in my data rather than something I was creating or generating. So I'm a theory tester of sort. And I've always wondered a little bit that we ask too much of authors in terms of theory, that every paper has to be a new theory. And I don't think that helps the scientific process very well. And I think what we do in entrepreneurship really well is we don't want atheoretical work. I mean, atheoretical work doesn't help anybody. It doesn't inform, it doesn't lead us forward. But we don't insist upon theory being front and center all of the time. There's a place for theory to be front and center, where theory contributions are the primary contributions of the paper. But I think as we talk more and more about replication crises in the social sciences, there's an opportunity for work to be great at testing and refining and pushing at the boundaries or the edges of the theories we have already to see how we can improve their application or test their application. And I think, especially, when Maroon has come in, we've become much better at looking for varieties of context in entrepreneurship. And that means that the theories we've had that have become comfortable theories in the context that have dominated the entrepreneurship literature for the last 30 years have had to be pushed and pulled and tested in new contexts and new varieties of situations that they haven't been before. And I think that's been something that ERD's been really good at in the last 4 or 5 years, but particularly the last 2 or 3 years, is looking to see where the theories we've had before work well or work poorly or need changed or don't work at all. And so again, where they are good or bad explanations of patterns of data that we hadn't been exposed to in the past because we weren't looking at those contexts, whether they might be contexts of poverty or particular industrial or geographic contexts, these sorts of things which weren't places or contexts we were interested in before.
What is your perspective of the extraordinary phenomenon of entrepreneurship?
So I love these questions. I did love this question too. So I don't teach much entrepreneurship anymore. I always felt a little bit of a charlatan when I did teach in the early parts of my career, and you teach new venture creation like most entrepreneurship academics do, because I felt if I could avoid any career in my life, it would be being an entrepreneur, because I've seen so many entrepreneurs and spent so much time with so many entrepreneurs and see how tough it is to do it really, really well. And so I've kind of avoided that. But so in that sense, I've always talked about how extraordinarily difficult it is to be it. So that and entrepreneurship then is an extraordinary phenomenon. But I've been absolutely convinced. Howard Aldrich has an argument that talks about our overemphasis on the extraordinary and our underemphasis of the ordinary. And much of entrepreneurship is pretty ordinary. And I think if we're going to make it a ubiquitous activity, everybody should be thinking entrepreneurially all of the time. Maybe not all of the time, but often. And if we're going to do that, we have to make it ordinary, not extraordinary. Because if we make things extraordinary, people say, well, I'm an ordinary person, I don't do extraordinary things. And it becomes a little bit of a get out, and so people avoid it. So now when I talk to students about entrepreneurship, I try my hardest to talk about how ordinary it is. It really is, it's the extraordinary, successful entrepreneurship is often the extraordinary execution of ordinary things, but it's that ordinariness of it all. you know, I'm going to make up a number, which is terrible for a quantitative person, but I'm sure I read something recently, like 40% of North American adult males have an episode of entrepreneurship in their career. 40% is a stunning number. Now, I made that number up, so I can't remember what the number is, but that's ballpark what it is. It's a really high number that, that very many people experience entrepreneurship, and it's because it is quite ordinary. Where it becomes extraordinary is in the detail, not in the overall picture. And I think, you know, so for me, like when I'm thinking about this consequences of episodes of entrepreneurship that I'm working on with colleagues here, it is about thinking about how doing something which is commonplace, being an entrepreneur for many people, that, you know, that happens for many people, has an impact on their subsequent career or their subsequent well-being and their subsequent perspectives on life, or, you know, these kinds of their health, all that kind of stuff. And so, like, getting at the ordinariness of it, I think is pretty important, without diminishing the fact that it really is a courageous activity, and people like me, you know, would avoid it because to do it well requires so much work and so much energy and creativity that it's quite daunting. So that makes it seem extraordinary, but so many people attempt it that there's something ordinary about it. So that's kind of how I think I want to think about it. I want to think about ordinary entrepreneurship. So a former editor-in-chief of our journal, Alastair Anderson, who was a great academic, but had also been a career entrepreneur. And when you think about career entrepreneur, you think, you know, was he Bill Gates or Elon Musk or anything? And Alastair wasn't. He owned restaurants and hotels. He owned a construction firm. And these are like ordinary things to most people. We understand these pretty well, and much of entrepreneurship is like that. That he was an extraordinary individual in many ways, but his entrepreneurship was yeah, I hope Alistair doesn't hate me for saying this, was ordinary, but in a brilliant kind of way. There's a paradox there, but I want to celebrate the ordinary as well as the extraordinary of entrepreneurship.
What are your tips to reach publication in ERD?
Yeah, so I don't know, you've probably done this as well. We're often asked to give presentations on how to get published, and you know, the early parts when I was invited to do them, I was obviously very flattered and I enjoyed doing them to PhD students or younger academics. But I've seen a couple relatively recently from editors at FT50 Journal, so Strategic Management Journal and others. And I've come away thinking, am I better prepared for that publication? And the answer typically is no. And I was telling this story to a colleague recently, and he said, well, of course, there are tricks in trades. As you go through it, you know, you got to think. I always say to my students, you're writing to be read. So where is the audience for your work? And so, you know, if you want to publish in Entrepreneurship Regional Development, you should read Entrepreneurship Regional Development. It's a fantastic journal. There's some great stuff in it. But really, you should read it to understand the conversations we are having, because you want to be part of a conversation. If you become part of that conversation, then there's more likelihood, one, that we want to publish your work because it contributes to a discussion we're having, but two, that people will read it and cite it and talk about it, and it'll have an impact in the academic community and beyond. So I think that's the starting point. Be a reader of the places you want to publish, and join the conversations, find conversations that are interesting. I don't know how many times we see papers that come to us that, you know, it's not apparent that the author or authors have read our journal ever, other than the title, and they go, entrepreneurship, I'm writing something that's vaguely about entrepreneurship, this will fit. And I think this is crazy. We've got, you know, some great work here and you're not reading it because you're not citing it, or we don't have that conversation. That's a conversation for Small Business Economics, or that's a conversation for Family Business Review or something like that. And often there is overlaps in those conversations, but so that's a starting point. And then beyond that, I think, you know, it's one of the things I do now in my part-time job at Lancaster University is I teach the quantitative methods component of the PhD methods course. And because we have a student with a variety of mathematical abilities, we don't actually teach them how to do quantitative methods, because we have 6 weeks and I can't teach some people to do simple t-tests and other people to do multi-level modeling or, you know, whatever it may be. So what we do instead is we talk about research design and research presentation. So we talk about how to do good quantitative research so that if they become quantitative researchers, they're more thoughtful designers of it and executioners of it. And if they don't do quantitative research, they're more critical readers of it and more capable readers of it. So we do it kind of that way. And the paper I asked them to read is a paper by Marco Mahler and Walter Stamm, that was at ETP 2021 maybe, which talks about how you do good quantitative research. And I think if I was somebody asked me, leaving aside the qualitative stuff and leaving aside you have interesting questions that you care about, leaving aside those kind of things, read the journal and understand the conversations. If it comes down to simply the mechanics of the paper, if you're a quantitative researcher, that's a must read, that paper. It's a fantastic paper. And to me, it sets out, you know, a great framework for thinking about how you do your work well as a designer and executor of quantitative research. And there must be equivalent papers in qualitative research. I'm just not familiar with them. And so thinking about best practice in your field is, and, you know, gets to my point about formulas, without making it a formula, without making it a here's a checklist that I have to go through, but thinking about, you know, the sort of philosophical ideas behind doing this stuff well, and that really is a great paper, and Marco and Wouter are both very smart guys, is a great way to do it. I guess the other thing that comes out, I mean, very long-winded, one of my other favourite anecdotes I tell students is, I stumbled across, and I'm sure many people have stumbled across this paper, this book chapter as well. Johan Wieklund wrote a book chapter about how to become Johan Wieklund, right? And so anybody who's met Johan knows that was probably a fun process to become Johan Wieklund, because he's a fun guy, as well as being very smart and very accomplished. But I always thought it was kind of weird. It's like, you know, if you'd asked a pop star or a football player, you know, how they became themselves, instead we were asking Johan how he became himself. But the cool thing about it is he talks about me-search rather than research. So doing things which you give a damn about, which you care about, becomes very important about it. And I think that's key. Like for most of the stuff I do now, and I'm very fortunate at this stage in my career that I'm not fighting for tenure and I have a research professorship and those kind of things. But even in the early parts of my career, I did things I cared about. I cared about studying. I was excited to know the answers to questions. I didn't go in, you know, with an answer in mind, but I was excited about the questions, and the questions mattered a great deal. And I think if you do that, I think there's a real danger as we get to this sort of publishment and perish mentality where quantity of publication seems to be a metric that people care about, that you start doing things you don't care very much about because you can do them quickly. I think Johan's advice on me-search is absolutely key to a happy career as well as a successful one, if you can, and to publishing good papers, because you can read that. I think when I read papers, and maybe I'm deluding myself, but I think when I read papers, I can read if the person really has put their heart and soul into it, if they really care about this work, if they've taken their time and been thoughtful, or if they've stumbled across a data set that they can quickly do a suite of analysis on, and here's the paper from the end of it. And you can feel the difference in those two as a reader and as a reviewer. And I review for a bunch of journals beyond ERD. And I see those papers and I'm always a little bit disheartening, because I'm looking for people to care. And so I think, and that doesn't mean it has to be new stuff. I mean, we don't have to be terrible neophytes chasing the latest idea and the latest fashion. We can care about questions that we've been talking about for 30 or 40 years, and we can say exciting things and get animated and agitated about them. But I think, you know, caring is a big part about what you do. It communicates itself very well in your work. And so, you know, understand the checklist well, but don't be a slave to it. You know, design your research fantastically well and write it up well and execute it well and do it with passion and honesty and integrity and care about the things you're doing. And when I come away from these presentations on how to publish, I always think, yeah, you could probably just shorten that to, you know, care about what you're doing, do it well, and do something that other people are interested in as well, I suppose, is the unfortunate thing that we do, we do need an audience. And so, you know, you do find people who do spectacular work about things they care that don't find publication because journals don't want it. I guess one last anecdote, sorry, I'm terribly long-winded, but one last anecdote. Sarah Jack and I, many years ago, were invited to a networking event for young academics in Gothenburg. And there was a bunch of people there. Dr. Clark was there, Dimo Dimov was there, I'm trying to think who else was there, but Denise Basaran was there. There was a bunch of younger European academics were kind of invited, and the leaders were Johan and Dean Shepherd. And I'd said earlier on, as we were chatting about what we've done very well in entrepreneurship and reasonable development, what Maruna's pioneered, I think, particularly well, is this idea of variety of context and understanding entrepreneurship as a various phenomena, a various phenomenon that happens in different places for different people and happens differently. And what Dean said at that presentation was never have, and I see this a lot, and I think you've missed an opportunity in publishing papers, never have a colon in your journal, in your article title, and afterwards the case of. So never say, you know, let's say an example, entrepreneurial bricolage, colon, the case of Scotland. He said, because nobody cares except Scottish people. You have to talk about how the case of Scotland helps us understand broader context and broader phenomena. And I see that a lot. So, like, you know, avoid too particularizing your work. The context matters a great deal, but how does your context help us understand other things and other places and other contexts? And so, you know, you have to move beyond the particular to the general, or at least to some extent of the general. So that's one. And then the other one I often see that frustrates me is poorly motivated comparisons. And so, you know, I'll have, you know, entrepreneurial bricolage, to use the same title, Pakistan compared to Israel, or Pakistan compared to France. And I'll think, so why would you compare Pakistan to France? What's the basis of that comparison? Or what I actually did see in the ERD was Singapore compared to Pakistan. And I'm like, so I can't imagine how they would be comparable on any basis. And so, again, good motivation for context matters a great deal. And, you know, we love context, and it's been a bit of an epiphany too late for entrepreneurship research, you know, from Frederica Velter 10, 15 years ago onwards, to say, well, context really matters, and it absolutely does. But when we say it matters, it's much more than a tagline. It really has to matter. It has to be part of your story and part of your theorizing, your explanations of the data you're studying.
Do you have other recommendation for authors?
I think, you know, bad research when you see it very quickly, because it has flaws. It's flawed in its design, it's flawed in its execution, and so, you know, the data is not fit for purpose, and usually it's a mismatch between, you know, data and, you know, between the method and the question. So here we've got a series of how many questions, but I've got, you know, a case study evidence, or I've got a series of process questions, but I've got a cross-sectional survey. And so there's often stuff like that that's fatally flawed. I think the tougher thing is, and so that's easy for researchers, I think, to avoid. And they can do that, you know, read that, you know, the Stam and Mala paper, or the Mala and Stam paper, or, you know, there's lots of great Herman Aguinas. So Herman has got great papers on just about it, and there really are thoughtful papers with great co-authors that you know, somebody should have, maybe there is a book, but there should be a collected book of those papers, which are often about research design and research methods, which are useful for any, you know, young academic to reflect upon as they do their work. So those things are easy to fix. It's the other stuff beyond that. So we can do technical good work, good research that doesn't really engage the reader and move it on. And I think I think that leap is often from that technically good work that doesn't excite and enthuse, and maybe will get published. But people, I mean, I'm sure authors do understand this, but we have competition for space. Not all technically good work makes it into ERD. Some technically good work doesn't make it in just because the contribution is insufficient. And so that's a challenge. You've got to be making a contribution, not just be doing competent research. And so that making a contribution, I really often think is about really investing in your research and caring enough about it. So it is that Johan Wiklund research, how you do that. And I think that's where a lot of our tier 2 and 3 journals are a little bit too indiscriminate, that they're, and maybe they've got space to fill, or maybe they feel that this is sufficient, but they'll publish competent research but doesn't make much of a contribution because it's not apparent that the authors have really invested time. So I, you know, I got a paper just now that's a rise and resubmit a journal that, again, I won't mention. That paper was written 4 years ago. The research project, the first time, it's been through 2 rounds with that journal. It's the first journal it went to, but it went to a couple of conferences first, and we beat the paper up ourselves, and we took it to friends, and we asked them for comments and all this stuff. We're fortunate we don't believe the data dates, the things we're saying dates, and so there isn't an urgency in the way there might be in some other things. But the project it came from was also 3 years before that. So here we have, you know, 7 years from now to our second round of revising and resubmit at a particular journal. Now, it shouldn't be like that all of the time. But, you know, we talk to our dean here a lot about the importance of patience in research, that if you want to do good research, it will take slightly longer. And that's because if you care enough about it and you want to do it properly well, it does take longer. There are no quick fixes, and quick research is not always, but is often mediocre. Busy mediocrity, I don't think, moves us forward a great deal. I think that patients in his journals, we have to understand that sometimes we're going to see data that was collected 3-4 years ago because it's gone through a process to get to that point. And we shouldn't, you know, unless there is a time dimension to it, like obviously the stuff that came out immediately after the COVID pandemic, that's important to come out then. But I think we're going to see COVID papers for the next 10 or 15 years because we're going to see the effects of COVID on entrepreneurship evolve and change over time as the challenges that entrepreneurs have faced have changed. But I think patience, I think, is another thing. So understanding that great research can and often does take a little bit of time, and that's not to suggest for a minute that my paper is great research, but from the stuff I've seen, you know, I often see great research, I read great research in other journals and in ERD, and I recognise that this has been the work of not months, but of years to make it happen. So be patient. I say this, one piece of advice I'd give younger scholars, and it's easy for me to do again at the stage of career I am at, is to be patient. I have a PhD student just now, and he's a wonderful guy, and he's super smart and very hardworking, but boy, is he in here, hurry. He wants to be finished this as quickly as he possibly can, and it's often at the expense of doing it as well as his talents allow him to do it, because he's in a little bit of a hurry. And so my advice to him always is just to slow down a little bit, reflect a little bit, take your time. We can do great work. And his answer is, that's easy for you to say, but I think it is good advice. I think it's to be patient. I'm very fortunate. My PhD supervisor was Richard Harrison, and I think Rich is a great polymath, but also a wonderfully smart guy. And he, I think, has always been a very thoughtful researcher, and he was a great role model for me in that respect. I don't think I was always faithful to his advice and to his role modeling, but as I've got older, maybe that's all it is. As I've got older, and you recognise some of the importance of some of the things he said back then.
Thanks a lot, Mark, for participating to our show and share your advice on how to publish in Entrepreneurship and Regional Development. All our podcasts are available on entrepreneurship-erd.com and on the main podcast platforms.
Thank you, Vincent.